Meaningless. Meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. And you want to say Happy New Year to you too. I mean, you go to shake the guy by the hand, wish him all the best for 2008, and he thumps you one in the solar plexus. It's not even as if he's some grumpy old has-been in Room 101, you know, that television program where people get a chance to consign a few of their pet hates to the rubbish tip. This isn't a few pet hates. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. It's not really a surprise that someone thinks that. I mean, plenty of people always have. The surprise, isn't it, is what's it doing in the Bible? I mean, you only hope it's because this teacher is facing up to the real questions of life. If you know anything about the teacher, as he likes to call himself, you'll know that meaningless is something of a catchphrase for him. But you hope he'll have something more to say before the end. But certainly the big questions do have to be faced. I got as one of my Christmas prizes John Humphreys' book in God We Doubt, Confessions of a Failed Atheist. John Humphreys, the Radio 4 Today program presenter. Whatever you think of him, he actually, I've just started the book, he introduces the issue very engagingly. Listen to this. He writes this. I still recall the exact times and places when the big questions declared themselves to my childish consciousness. We all have our own versions of them, with the possible exception of one or two people who probably left the womb knowing all the answers to everything they were ever likely to be asked. But most of them went into politics and spent half their time dodging questions. The first of my own big questions arrived when I was in short trousers and knew even less than I know today. I'd been playing with some friends on a disused aerodrome near my home in Cardiff. The war had ended only a few years earlier, but small boys like us were still fighting it every day. We used the abandoned carcasses of old aircraft to attack the squadrons of imaginary German bombers droning above us in the darkening sky. When we'd wiped them out, mercifully suffering no casualties of our own, my friends went home for tea. I hung around. It was one of those days when my mother, a hairdresser who worked from home, was giving a perm to a neighbour, and I hated the stench of the chemicals. The glory of the night sky had yet to be lost to light pollution, and on cloudless nights the stars went on forever. That was what troubled me. How could they go on forever? And if the universe was everything, what was it all in? And how could it be in anything? Because that would have to be in something else, and so on. And what was there before any of it existed? And how did it all come into existence? And finally, the really, really big question, why? In the old cockpit of my battle-scarred fighter, I was worried and slightly scared. Dealing with the worst the Luftwaffe could throw at us had been no problem. Being alone in the indifferent immensity of the universe, that was something else. It was an even bigger anxiety than the trouble I'd be in with my mother for being late home for tea. The other big question came to me at about the same age. I was on a bus returning from our week's holiday in Aberystwyth. I hated buses. I was always sick on them. And the journey from Cardiff to Aberystwyth on a pre-war bus, many years before anyone had thought of motorways, was a long one. It was while I was hanging over the platform at the back, banished there by the conductor for obvious reasons, that I discovered mortality. For the first time in my short life, I realized that one day I would die. Once again, the question was, why? What was the point of being born if all there was to look forward to was dying? Everything is meaningless, says the teacher. And you suspect John Humphreys would sense a kindred spirit, don't you? As someone not afraid to ask the big questions or even face some bleak answers. So we'd better not shy away from following him either. Come and have a look at this section from verses 3 to 11. I've called it Life Summarized. Life Summarized by a Shrug. Look, verse 3. What does man gain from all his labor at which he toils under the sun? It's that infuriating teenager's shrug of the shoulders, isn't it? Whatever. And you notice the under the sun phrase? It's another common phrase for the teacher. He uses it more than 35 times in the book, 4 times in this chapter. Here in verse 4, again in verse 9. What has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There's nothing new under the sun. A little variation in verse 13. I devoted myself to study and to explore by wisdom all that's done under heaven. And there it is again in verse 14. I've seen all the things that are done under the sun. Under the sun, under heaven. It's really meaning if you keep your feet firmly planted on the ground, if you limit yourself to the here and now, to time and space as we see it and know it, if there's no special pleading to invisible powers above, then all you can do is shrug. Verse 4. Generations come, generations go, but the earth remains forever. Nothing really changes. The sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. There'll be another day. The wind blows in the south and turns to the north. Round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. All streams flow into the sea. Yet the sea is never full. To the place the streams come from, there they return again. And you know the teacher has done his geography GCSE, don't you? You know, he knows about evaporation and condensation and precipitation and all those other things. What goes around comes around. You can be a David Attenborough. You can film as many Planet Earth series as you like. You can marvel, you can wonder, you can gasp. But however much you study the world of nature, you're not going to find a meaning to life. At least, not one that satisfies. All things are wearisome. More than one can say, the eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear its fill of hearing. I mean, switch for a moment to the world of the techies. Nor the ear its fill of hearing. It's so true, isn't it? You know the people who always have to have the latest sound system? They probably already spent their Christmas money on it. They can explain all the gizmos, all the advantages, completely lost on an ear like mine, but vital differences to them. Will they be satisfied? Never. By next Christmas, there'll be another must-have they need to get that'll make all the difference to the sound quality. What has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There's nothing new under the sun. You see, it's Groundhog Day. Same old routine, different day. It's a feeling that catches up on any individual. It's a principle that's painted on broader canvases too. History repeats itself, Steve Turner wrote. It has to. No one's listening. Last year, as the British troops went into Helmand province in Afghanistan, one BBC reporter added a throwaway line in his 10 o'clock news report. He just said this, "You wonder if anyone's read any of the history books." Because invading armies entering Afghanistan and losing have a consistent track record over the years. One newspaper journalist covering the US presidential elections the other day wrote of the importance of candidates with a strong grasp of foreign policy and added cynically, "After all, where would America be today if she hadn't learnt the lessons of the Vietnam War?" Is there anything of which one can say, "Look, this is something new"? It was here already long ago. It was here before our time. It's not that the teacher is blind to inventions. He's just alert to the deeper storylines. What's dominated the news? in these days since Christmas. A political assassination. Allegedly rigged elections. Tribal warfare. Trains that don't run on time. There's nothing new under the sun. There's no remembrance of men of old. And even those who are yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow. People quickly get forgotten. In 20 years' time, who in all souls is going to remember you? In 100 years' time, who's going to remember any of us? By 2200, people will have forgotten our children. That's life. It's all very contemporary, this way of thinking, isn't it? I mean, postmodernists with their denial of a meta-narrative, any overarching explanation for life and history, will nod at the teacher. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. It could be taken straight out of one of their handbooks. Or listen to Professor Richard Dawkins, writing in his book, River Out of Eden. The universe we observe has precisely the proportions we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, and no good. Nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. As that unhappy poet A.E. Housman put it, for nature, heartless, witless nature, will neither care nor know. DNA neither cares nor knows. DNA just is. And we dance to its music. You feel if Dawkins read The Teacher, he wouldn't just say, at last, someone asking the big questions, but at last, someone giving the honest answers. Because if you're just going to look at the world as it is under the sun, says the teacher, and Dawkins has no intention of looking anywhere else, then life summarized by a shrug. And if you start there, I mean, who knows where you'll land up? I mean, don't expect to get very far, do you, if you're going to begin with meaningless, utterly meaningless. I was on the tube the other day. I saw an advert up there for an Aussie hair shampoo. And they got these lines on it. The secret of a long, happy life? No idea. The secret of long, happy hair? No problem. And the strap line went, there's more to life than hair, but it's a good place to start. You know, wonderfully, absurdly trivial, isn't it? Well, there's more to the teacher, you'll be glad to hear, than the Aussie shampoo advert. So let him introduce himself. And he does so in verse 12, doesn't he? I, the teacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. So not at first sight, this book, the blog, the diaries of a moody teenager or student. Nor are they to be dismissed as the ramblings of a midlife crisis or the jottings of a grumpy old man. Now, I devoted myself, he says, to study and to explore by wisdom all that's done under heaven. In other words, this is serious research that's got into the book. This isn't just life summarized as if for some pithy advert on the tube. It's also life studied. And he spells it out for us in verses 12 to 18. Life studied, it's as if I'm reading his PhD thesis. And it has been thorough research. He hasn't confined himself to the library. I devoted myself to study and to explore, he says. As we'll discover vividly next week. He's tried it out firsthand. No expenses spared. And he's written it to save us having to wander down the same cul-de-sacs. It's worth an honest study over the next few weeks. Because the teacher is no fool. You saw how he introduced himself at the very beginning of the book, the words of the teacher, son of David. He's got the wisdom of Solomon. But what he's trying to say to us is that brains alone can't solve life. Come back to verse 13. I devoted myself to study and to explore by wisdom all that is done under heaven. What a heavy burden God has laid on men. I've seen all the things that are done under the sun. All of them are meaningless, a chasing after the wind. What is twisted cannot be straightened. What is lacking cannot be counted. I thought to myself, look, I've grown and increased in wisdom more than anyone who's ruled over Jerusalem before me. I've experienced much of wisdom and knowledge. And then I applied myself to the understanding of wisdom and also of madness and folly. But I learned that this too is a chasing after the wind. For with much wisdom comes much sorrow. The more knowledge, the more grief. Now please, don't reduce him to a nostalgia freak, longing for the good old days. Now, he's not one of those. Later on in his book, he'll say this, do not say, why were the old days better than these? For it is not wise to ask such questions. Don't you think that's well put? Remember the link, will you? You know, next time the parents start on the good old days and not wise go together. And don't imagine he's anti-intellectual or despises wisdom. That would be to misunderstand him too. I mean, just look across the page to chapter 2 and to verse 12. I turn my thoughts to consider wisdom and also madness and folly. What more can the king's successor do than what's already been done? I saw that wisdom is better than folly. Just as light is better than darkness. The wise man has eyes in his head, while the fool walks in the darkness. Wisdom is better than folly, he says. Later on again, he'll describe it as an evil when he sees a fool in high places in a nation. You sometimes think the 21st century world still knows that evil, don't you? He's got wonderful little cameos of the value of practical wisdom as opposed to folly. Here's one of his great lines. If a snake bites before it is charmed, there is no profit for the charmer. You see the picture? There is the fool, telling you how clever he is, how good at charming the snake, and before he can finish bragging about himself and how good he is, the snake's bitten him. What good does that do the charmer? Now the teacher's no fool. But the teacher will allow no glib answers. Wisdom is better than folly. But brains and PhDs won't solve the meaning of life. Look how verse 14 goes on. The wise man has eyes in his head, while the fool walks in the darkness. But I came to realize that the same fate overtakes them both. Then I thought in my heart, the fate of the fool will overtake me also. What then do I gain by being wise? I said in my heart, this too is meaningless, for the wise man, like the fool, will not be long remembered. In days to come, both will be forgotten. Like the fool, the wise man too must die. It's John Humphreys at the back of the bus again, isn't it? Now, what's the point of being born if all there is to look forward to was dying? At the end of the day, the professor lands up food for the worms 6 foot under or a pile of ashes, just like the fool does. I mean, you could put it more tactfully, but that's the gist of it, isn't it? And see, again, there are problems that wisdom can see, but not solve. I mean, come back to chapter 1 and see what he says again there in verse 15. What is twisted cannot be straightened. What is lacking cannot be counted. In fact, the teacher sees this twisting that can't be unraveled as something quite deliberate. Keep a finger in chapter 1 and just turn on a few pages to chapter 7, will you, and verse 13. See what he writes here. Chapter 7, verse 13. Consider what God has done. Who can straighten what he has made crooked? As if he's saying God has made this world so that we can't explain it. There is a frustration, a not being able to work it out, that is built into it. It's part of what the Apostle Paul in the New Testament will describe as God subjecting the creation to frustration. In Romans 8. And gone is the "and it was very good" of Genesis 1. That the David Attenboroughs of this world will show us. More than that, we're not the people of Genesis 1 either. Just turn to the very end of chapter 7, verse 29. And you see what he writes here. "This only have I found, God made mankind upright, but men have gone in search of many schemes, much deviousness." See, we're made upright. We're living crooked. In fact, this is the twist that's resulted in God subjecting creation to frustration. It's why when Professor Richard Dawkins sets up his great God of reason, he misses two vital points. Firstly, we have a world that can be studied, explored, marveled at, but not ultimately explained by that reason. And secondly, the deviousness of human thinking affects even the reasoning of a mighty brain like his. Now, if you do realize that, it can only add to the frustration. And the teacher knows it. Come back to chapter 1. Come back to that last verse there. Verse 18, as he comes to see it, wise enough to see the problem, not wise enough to solve it, "for with much wisdom comes much sorrow, the more knowledge, the more grief." Albert Einstein and Bertrand Russell were probably the two of the greatest brains of the 20th century. They got together once and wrote a little booklet, and it included this sentence, "We have found that the men who know the most are the most gloomy." And thousands of years earlier, the teacher said the same thing, didn't he? The more knowledge, the more grief. But then, as he also said, there's nothing new under the sun. If life summarized just gets us a shrug, then life studied only seems to bring a sigh. Now, those who know these kind of talks will be hoping very much that point 3 is life solved and will give us a smile, or at least cheer us up. Well, we may get there, but not too quickly. Because the teacher is certainly no atheist, and his book is in the Bible for a purpose, but this isn't a book that just brings G-O-D, God, in as a simple answer to all my problems. If we stay under the sun, then it's hard to justify meaning and purpose to life with a God limited to the here and now, to time and space. The teacher is no atheist, but as we've seen, he won't allow glib answers either, even if they have got the God word in them. Some of our evangelical certainties don't always appear, do they, to face the horrors and the injustices, the realities of life under the sun. And the teacher won't let us get away with that. He may lead us to life solved, but not without testing some of our more neatly packaged ideas and beliefs. But he won't let us give up on life either. He doesn't share Richard Dawkins's contentment with a life spent merely dancing to the music of blind nature. He believes there is meaning and purpose to life and knows where they can be found. He understands why you feel you're important, even when all of life seems to be telling you you're just a string of DNA molecules in an impersonal cosmos. Or if you tell me, no, I don't feel important, that's my problem, I lack self-esteem. Why do you lack self-esteem? Because you think you ought to be more important than you feel. Now, he understands that. C.S. Eliot said, "Humankind cannot bear very much reality." But the teacher won't short-circuit reality. He won't rush us to answers before we first face our own bankruptcy. he's also aware that without God, left to the here and now, life is reduced to a shrug, a sigh. But we'll have to patiently follow him these next few weeks as he rubs our noses in that truth. However, like many an excited teacher, he can't resist dropping clues as he goes. And there's more than one kind of knowledge and wisdom. As you look at verses 12 to 18, did you notice where his wisdom comes from? Verse 13, I devoted myself to study. Verse 14, I have seen. Verse 16, I thought to myself, look, I've grown in wisdom. I have experienced. Verse 17, then I applied myself. Well, now look across the page, will you? Look to chapter 2 and just see in verse 26 how he drops in a very different note. And he writes this, to the man who pleases him, God gives wisdom, knowledge, happiness. Look under the sun, you'll only get a shrug or a sigh. But there is a wisdom from outside that can lead to the smile. And at Christmas, the one from outside was given. Jesus, who is our wisdom, appeared. He knows the realities and the frustrations of life under the sun. And, well, see it this way. Look back to verse 3 of chapter 1. Will you see that first question that the teacher asks? What does man gain from all his labor at which he toils under the sun? Do you see it there? Keep it in mind, will you then, as you leave Ecclesiastes and turn on a few hundred pages to page 1012, to Mark chapter 8. What does man gain from all his labor at which he toils under the sun? Now look at verse 36. What good is it for a man to gain the whole world, yet forfeit his soul? Here's Jesus asking a similar question, a fair question, in John Humphrey's language, one of the big questions. How can we live wisely without the answer? He's given it strikingly in the verse before. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for me and for the gospel will save it. Save from pointlessness and meaninglessness as well as a godless eternity. What good is it for a man to gain the whole world yet forfeit his soul? Or what can a man give in exchange for his soul? If anyone's ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, in the here and now, under the Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes in his Father's glory with the holy angels. Jesus says we'll discover that there is a truth that's found out there. There is more to life than just under the sun. But that's for another week. So what have I learned as I've started letting the teacher teach me? Well, here's a couple of things I've picked up as I've been looking at him this week. Firstly, to expect questions from life. To be free, even as a Christian, to face the bleak realities of life under the sun. There's no need to pretend they're not there. But secondly, I realize I've got to humble myself to listen to God if I'm ever going to understand. Well, you say, that's just the sort of thing preachers do say, isn't it? No. Please, listen more carefully. You see, it's built into me to want to find it all out for myself. The way I've been brought up, the way I've been educated, it has been to be self-sufficient. And this teacher will drive me to despair to make me listen to the only voice with an answer. It comes very unnaturally to nearly all of us to listen to someone else for the answer. I think the writer of our last hymn knew just a little of that. I came to Jesus as I was, weary and worn and sad. I found in him a resting place, and he has made me glad.